Thanks, Rob. It's Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, Chef Fabio Viviani will be here, the Top Chef alum, who is the man behind Bar Sienna and Sienna Tavern here in Chicago. We'll talk about his career in our first Industry Night segment of 2018. Also coming up, Frank Mondry is going to join us. We'll talk about the Year of Creative Youth and the open house at the Chicago Children's Theater this weekend. And Roderick Dixon, the famed tenor, opera singer, sings with the orchestra, symphony orchestra, and so many other things. He's going to be at the Auditorium Theater this weekend, and he is live, performing live in Studio 435 tonight. There you go, a little classical for you tonight here on The Download. Well, my guest tonight at the big table is the author of the new book, A Few Red Drops, The Chicago Race Riot of 1919. Claire Hartfield has written an extensive book chronicling one of Chicago's ugliest moments. A race riot erupted after a white man threw a rock at black teenagers on a raft as they drifted too close to the all-white beach on 29th Street. The rock struck the boy, killing him. And what happened over the course of the next week ended with 38 people killed and over 500 more injured. But the book goes deeper than just the fateful week in July of 1919. Hartfield spends most of the book on what led up to the riots and how the incident on the beach was the result of racial tensions simmering over the course of years. The story of the stockyards, the neighborhoods around it, the fight for equality and fair housing, organized labor and the early corporate barons, politics and police, and ultimately race and identity. It's a stirring tale that sounds all too familiar in 2018, and as Carl Sandburg wrote so eloquently at the time, sometimes I growl, shake myself, and splatter a few red drops for history to remember. Then I forget. Author Claire Hartfield in studio tonight. Claire, thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
This is a great book. I really enjoyed it. This was a great read, and I appreciate you coming in. Well, I mean, where's the idea come from? Because I mentioned it to Ro Khan. I mentioned it to the guests that are on the show, and everyone's like, oh, yeah, that story. Everyone knows the story. But what I read in this book was a story that I wasn't familiar with. Talk about the impetus for writing this book to start.
Yeah. So I actually first heard about this story myself when I was just a little girl. A little bit of oral history in my family. And my grandmother was a wonderful woman, and she used to tell me stories about when she was young. And one of the stories she told me was about when she came up to Chicago to live from New Orleans.
Wow.
She had grown up in the South, and she was very excited, and she got herself an apartment in what was called the Black Belt at that time in Chicago. And she got herself a job in a factory in the industrial community. She was loving her life. So one day, she gets on the streetcar to come home from work. And as she rode closer and closer to the black community, there were these mobs of young men, both black and white, out in the streets that she could see through the window. And they were fighting and throwing rocks at the streetcar, and she was scared out of her mind.
Yeah.
She made it home safely, so it had a good ending for a small child. but you know how it is when you're young and you hear these stories that are sort of full of fear. And so it stuck with me. And I think I kind of buried it in the back of my mind, as you do, for many years. But then a few years ago, of course, we started experiencing a lot of turbulence in our own lives now. And I was seeing these scenes of people in the streets on my television. And it called up this memory of this story that my grandmother had told me. And I wanted to know more. I wanted to know what was going on back then, almost 100 years ago, and how does it relate or not relate to what we're going through today?
Is it easy to find this stuff? I mean, when I see all of the documents, and in the book, there's great, you know, you'll have some of the archival information, some of the pictures, but also some of the headlines from the newspapers and otherwise. Is it easy to find in Chicago archives the stories of 1919 and before?
Well, we got really lucky on this one. the city, in the aftermath of the riot, appointed a commission of six blacks and six whites to look into why did this happen and what are we going to do about it going forward. And they spent an entire year looking back at this and hired a couple of really important staff people to go out and interview people of all kinds, police officers, you know, politicians, the man on the street, everybody. And then they compiled this huge report.
Wow.
And so it was a treasure trove for me.
Oh, I can't even imagine.
Because
right.
It's original.
Yeah.
source material. And then another big source, of course, are newspapers. And so I went back through a lot of those. Some of the key ones were in the Chicago Defender, which was the biggest black newspaper around at that time, and the Chicago Tribune. So those were two of the big ones, but also the Chicago Daily News, the labor journals were amazing. I mean, there were some labor journals that go back to the 1800s and have stories that you can piece together. And it was important to me because I love history, but I particularly love it if you can get a taste of what actual people were going through. And that's easier to do when people are famous because they leave behind this huge trail of what they did. It's harder to do, especially the further back you go, with ordinary people on the street. And so one of the fun things about the research is going through this material and finding these gems and saying, wow, now I really get it. I understand what was going on.
And what is also fascinating in this book is the inconsistencies or the inaccuracies between the reports. I mean, whether the Defender might say it's one way, the Tribune might say it's the other way, but your research says it was neither.
Right.
I mean, you see a lot of the misinformation that was swirling around this
riot. Of course,
that
echoes today as well.
Yeah.
It does. And of course, there were not as many media outlets back then, but there were enough newspapers that they geared their content toward their particular audience. So that's another fascinating thing about doing the research is what you might see in a newspaper that's geared toward the black community is very different than what you might see in the Tribune, which is primarily was geared more toward the white middle class, and then the Chicago Labor Journal, which was geared toward the white working class.
Yeah, labor.
And they were all really different.
There's so much to get into, and we're going to get into it tonight. And we'll start. I'm fascinated because, you know, this story, like I said, I mean, it does obviously start with what happened on the beach. And that's the famous story we all know in Chicago. It started the race riot in 1919. But your story then goes back and traces back where some of this tension came from. Claire Hartfield's in studio with me tonight. She's the author of A Few Red Drops, The Chicago Race Riot of 1919. We'll get into the story and talk about all the factors that went into this ugly memory for the city of Chicago when we return. So stay with us. It's a download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest tonight at the big table is Claire Hartfield. She's the author of A Few Red Drops, The Chicago Race Riot of 1919, a great book. We'll talk about some of the places that she'll be reading from, the American Writers Museum right here, 57th Street Books. We'll get to all that in the hour to let you know where you can check it out. The story is one that a lot of Chicagoans know. I mean, you've heard of the story from your grandmother. And I mean, I know of it. And I guess we start the story on the beach. This was really a story that Chicago was a place that was not like the South, that there were no segregation laws, but it almost self-segregated itself.
Yeah, it's interesting. That summer of 1919 actually was a summer of unrest across this country. And so Chicago was not the first one. And interestingly, there had been a riot in Washington, D.C. And this was shortly before what happened in Chicago. And the New York Times came out with an article right after that saying this could not possibly happen in the North. And then a few days later, boom, it did.
So what I found interesting is that, you know, a lot of the cities in the South, and I guess it's what the New York Times referring to, is there already was segregation. There was Jim Crow laws. There were a lot of things that we know about American history that were not pristine. And you come to Chicago. Chicago was a progressive city in the sense that it wasn't a segregated city by law.
Right.
But the enclaves and the ethnic enclaves that surrounded the stockyards and everything that around, they found a way to segregate themselves.
Yes.
Including the beaches.
Chicago was actually a pretty segregated city, even at that time. Most blacks lived in a confined space, which was a small space on the near south side, called the Black Belt, actually, so that tips you off, right? Mm-hmm. And it's now what is the northern end of Bronzeville. It didn't extend as far down. There weren't as many people living here at that time. And as you say, there wasn't official segregation. So black and white children went to school together, or by law, they went to school together. Blacks and whites rode the streetcars together. Blacks and whites could go to any park that they wanted to, by law. But there was unofficial segregation pretty much everywhere. And one of those places was the lakefront. So it's kind of nutty in a way when you think about it now. But there was a space of beach that was just a half a mile long, not long at all. And there was an unofficial designation of a white beach, and right next to it, the unofficial designation.
Yeah, like 29th Street was the white beach, 26th Street was the black.
Knew
and everyone
it.
Just was okay
and
with it.
And for a long time, nobody crossed that line. But underneath the surface, of course, there were all these tensions that were percolating. And you know how it is, I think, in my personal life sometimes, there's a small thing that happens, it doesn't seem that big, and then it gets out of control, and you think, oh my God, how did this happen?
Yeah.
And then you kind of go back to it later and you think, oh, there was stuff there underneath the surface and I just didn't, it didn't percolate up to my consciousness.
The in Chicago at the time, and you talked about the Black Belt in the Bronzeville area, this would be the 23rd Street to 29th, 30th Street.
All the way down to like Pershing or
something. Yeah, okay, there you go. Just along State Street in Chicago. But that was an area that, that was sort of designated to the Black Belt. But just to the west, as we know, you had Packingtown, which was all the neighborhood, the ethnic neighborhoods, white ethnic neighborhoods, Lithuanian, Polish, Irish, that were all around the stockyards. Talk about that area, because those are Canaryville, Bridgeport, back in the yards, we know it today.
Exactly. So white immigrants came over from Europe in waves. So the first wave was primarily Irish and German. And the Irish, that was that would have been around the 1840s, because there was a great famine in Ireland. And this is a whole nother story, I think. But if you look back at Irish history, there were a lot of commonalities between the way these Irish Catholics were living and the way sharecroppers were living. Down in the south, they rented land. They were tenant farmers. They barely had enough to keep them going. And then there was this famine, potato famine, and they were kicked out of their homes. They had nowhere to go. A million of them died, and the rest of them tried to leave. So you had this great wave coming over. And when they came to the United States, they had a lot of hopes for a better life. But it turned out when they got here that whites who were already living in America were not very receptive to them
being. Right. There was already, I mean, it's pointed out in the book, the negative stereotypes. There's even in the paper, I think the Chicago Tribune has a picture of.
And Harper's Weekly.
And Harper's Weekly, But there was a negative stereotype in America of the Irish immigrant that was coming.
There really was. And in a sort of ironic twist on all of this, they were compared to blacks, actually, as being sort of the lowest on the pecking order of whites. Next to blacks. Anyway, what they ended up doing was they turned inward, which makes a lot of sense, and became self-reliant. And so they created this community, which ended up being Bridgeport, and then Canaryville is just south of there.
Mm-hmm.
And this was when they just came over with nothing. Now, as some of them moved up the ladder, they moved out of that area and into other areas and assimilated. And that's where you get what some Chicagoans know some talk about as the shanty Irish and the lace curtain Irish. And so they did split into two groups, which is different than what happened in the black community, where blacks of all economic groups were confined into this one area.
It's the stockyards play such a huge role in the book. They're one of the major characters because the meatpacking plants were the big employer in Chicago at the time. Obviously, there was the moment in which the stockyards became automated in a way that they went from just serving the local communities to the whole country.
Yeah.
There were a lot of corporate barons, the people who, you know, the Swifts and other people that were at the top of that who had vested interest in playing against the working class, playing against ethnic groups for their own monetary gain or just to be able to keep order. There was a lot of that I didn't know about that played out, and a lot of the racial tension came from what was happening at the stockyard.
Yeah, it did. It's interesting. As I started my research, I thought, I'll go back a couple of years from the riot, and it'll all be there. But every time I went back a few years, it led me back a few more years. And so, yes, Chicago became such a big industrial center starting in the around 1860 or so. Particularly, the stockyard opened in 1865 as the world's biggest stockyard, but we were also the world's biggest grain storage town, and also with respect to lumber. So it was there was just industry everywhere, and you look at it in this way: the employers, the industrialists, obviously wanted to make as much profit as they could, and they approached that in a few different ways. Yeah. One is that they approached it by being very innovative, and those are really good things. So the first refrigerated car, which was able to carry meat from one city to another, was invented by someone that was hired by Gustavus Swift. So things that have carried us forward
And the other side of the coin was right. the way that they were able to figure out a way to make money off of unskilled labor instead of the butchers
exactly.
that were in the class of butchers that were there at the time.
Right. So they invented sort of the first assembly line. And it's interesting that people usually think of that in conjunction with the auto industry. But Henry Ford, in his autobiography, actually credited the meatpacking industry for coming up with this. And what it did was it allowed the meatpackers to chop the job of, well, that's a pun, I guess, chop the job of chopping up cows and pigs up into many different small jobs where you didn't really need to be skilled to do that.
Because at the time, butchering was a skill. It was a profession in the way that a lot of people did it, and they were able to could butcher an entire pig or an entire cow. But it was a little bit more laborious in the way that it took time to be able to do that, and the industrialists figured out a machine, and unskilled laborers could do that faster.
Exactly. The machines were something that the supervisors could control, and so they would speed them up whenever they wanted to. The conditions that the unskilled labor worked in were really awful, and I talk about that a bit in the book. And, of course, also with switching from skilled to unskilled labor, the wages went down. And so the tool that the workers glommed onto was the labor union. And in order to succeed, the labor union needed unity among the workers. And so that's a recurring theme and frustration among the workers, because there are continually new obstacles in terms of getting that unity.
It's so interesting to me because, you know, knowing the unions of today and thinking back to that time and the turn of the century, there was a lot of distrust because it was a white labor force, mm-hmm. and they wanted blacks to be a part of it because they were also part of the unskilled labor. But whenever they'd get into a negotiation with the industrialists for contract or to end a strike, in the case of waitresses, it came down to where they said, well, okay, we'll let you take away the rights of black waitresses as long as you keep the white ones. They would betray the black workers in a way in negotiations. So you can understand why at the time that caused tension, because the blacks would not follow the idea of being a part of the labor union.
Yeah. For many years, up until World War I, blacks were not even, for the most part, allowed to be a part of the industrial plants. They worked in the service industry. And so that was a source of tension already, because they felt, we've been here for hundreds of years and we're locked out of these jobs. But even in the service industry, as you said, they did make a try with the labor unions, and it ended up really badly for them. At first, it ended up well. They had, on their first try, they were united, and they were able to get the first equal wage scale for blacks and whites in the city for the city's waiters, mm-hmm. and that was a huge success. But a few years later, the union sold them out. And this, of course, was partly because they were constantly battling with the employers, who were, their whole mode of operation was divide and conquer. So it was the unions going for unity versus the employers going for divide and conquer, and it was real tough.
And it caused a lot of tension, especially when there were strikes and you needed workers to come in, non-union workers, scabs, and a lot of times they were black workers that came in, which caused a huge amount of tension at the beginning part of the 20th century. Claire Hartfield's my guest in studio. She's the author of A Few Red Drops, The Chicago Race Riot of 1919. That's what we're talking about tonight. You know, you can check out Claire. She's going to be reading from the book at the American Writers Museum here on Michigan Avenue tomorrow night, 6 to 7:30 p.m. She's also going to be reading on Martin Luther King Day at 57th Street Books in Hyde Park, same time, 6 o'clock. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll get the news with Rob Martier. We'll come back more with Claire Hartfield here on The Download. Stay with us. Rob, it is The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. My guest at the big table this hour, Claire Hartfield. She's the author of A Few Red Drops, The Chicago Race Riot of 1919. We're talking about, of course, the famous riot of the killing of a black teenager on the beach, 29th Street, and how that set off a week-long riot in the city of Chicago that 38 people died, 500 people were injured, mobs all over neighborhoods and guns and knives. I mean, it's just an ugly moment for the city of Chicago and the country, because it was just one of a set of riots that happened that summer, 1919. But we're talking specifically about what led to that, not necessarily about that action. We'll get to what happened during that week, but Claire has done an extensive job of explaining how we got to this moment in 1919. And one of the issues had to do with neighborhoods. As we mentioned, the Black Belt was an area where blacks lived in Chicago at the time. On the other side, right by the stockyards, you had what was Packingtown, which was Canaryville, Bridgeport, Back of the Yards. And those were named later, but the Packingtown is what it was. And you had ethnic whites, Irish, Polish, Lithuanian in that area. But this is all a precursor for what was going to happen in Chicago, which was the Great Migration.
Right.
And the migration of blacks from the South to come to Chicago looking for opportunity. And that made a big impact on the city of Chicago as we know today. I mean, it was a huge moment. But also at that time, it kind of stoked a lot of the tensions that we're talking about.
Yeah, it was huge. And I'm going to try to give you a really encapsulated summary of how this all came about. Basically, in 1917, when the United States entered World War I, lots of the working class whites, as well as blacks, went off to war, and it left lots of empty spots on the assembly lines. And at the same time, the factories were being called upon to ramp up their production. And so they needed a new source of labor. And there was slim pickings in Chicago. There was just not much left. But there was this large labor pool in the South of blacks who primarily lived in rural areas. And they lived in really oppressive conditions under Jim Crow in the South. And they barely made enough to get by. And so the idea of coming up to Chicago and making more money than they'd ever made in their lives and living in a much freer environment, even though Chicago was not a perfect place for blacks, it was a lot better. And this was happening all over the country. So blacks streamed up to take these jobs in the North, and that was the first wave of the Great Migration.
It's amazing, too, because the Chicago Urban League, who we've had on this program, mm-hmm. played a big role in greeting people coming off the trains and letting them know what was up in Chicago when it comes to housing, where to stay, how to act, find work. I think one of the things said not to be lazy. This thing, there was a lot that was put in, but it was for a particular some of the people coming from the South. It was an eye opener that they were greeted by blacks in suits in these offices, and the Chicago Urban League sort of being organized.
It was. I mean, even though the South and the North, the rural and the urban, were in the same country, in some ways, culturally, they were like two different countries. And what made it particularly challenging was that during the space of those two war years, the black population actually doubled from 50,000 to 100,000. And so there was so much to do. There was housing to find for all of them, which was a huge problem. The jobs were there. But getting them
in the meantime, right?
They were there for the short term, anyway, for the period of the war, which was why they came in the first place. But the Urban League set itself up specifically at that time to connect the workers to the jobs and to prepare them to be able to do them well, with the idea that they were going to be living here. They weren't going to go back down to the South when the war was over.
You know, the neighborhoods, as we mentioned at the beginning of this segment, it is amazing to me because what essentially happened was the population doubled, but the space did not.
Exactly.
Because where the Black Belt was, and it was sandwiched by white ethnic neighborhoods, there was no give for blacks to live anywhere else but the Black Belt.
That's right. They were surrounded, well, on the east side were middle-class whites, actually. And on the west side, there were the working class whites. And then to the south, it was fairly middle class. But in any event, they were shooed in. And then to the north, it was an industrial area. So there was nowhere for them to go unless they moved into neighborhoods that were previously all white. And it was a disaster. There was not nearly enough housing for this 50,000 new people. People were walking the streets not because they were delinquent, but because they had nowhere to stay. The conditions got very unsanitary. There was a lot of illness that developed because of this overcrowding. And blacks that had the wherewithal said, I'm out of here. And they started to push into these previously white neighborhoods, and it caused a real backlash from the white community.
And we tie it into jobs. The war is coming to an end. A lot of the industrialists at the time who needed those spaces filled didn't need the spaces filled anymore. A lot of the vacancies that were open went to whites.
Absolutely.
The blacks were out of work. There were no jobs. There were no housing. You can understand why times got desperate in the city of Chicago.
They really did. I think, if I can remember this, I'm not perfect with statistics, but I believe that blacks saw the loss of 15,000 jobs between January and May of 1919. That's a lot of jobs.
That's a lot, yeah.
So you've got 15,000 new people unemployed.
And so one of the issues was that, when there was a strike or need a new job that came about, some black workers would work for less, would cross a picket line, would do things that needed to be done to feed their family. And that did not bode well for the ethnic whites who held those jobs or wanted those jobs in particular.
Absolutely. There was the tension accelerated during that period because basically the interests of working class whites and the interests of working class blacks conflicted with one another. Whites were the ones who would normally get the first, first ones to get the job. And blacks were usually last hired, first fired. So there was a difference there. Whites felt more secure in their jobs. The issue for whites was that they wanted better working conditions and better salaries. And the way that they saw to do that was through workers coming together in the union. And blacks were not so sure that that was what was in their own best interest.
We talked about it early in the hour that they had already been kind of double-crossed by unions in the past.
And they felt that they might be again. And in addition to that, the employers were throwing in some perks to sweeten the pot and make them think, gee, if I rock the boat here, I'm going to be the one who's the odd man out. So there was tension there and a lot of finger pointing that was based on race.
The other part of this is we talked about housing not being available, and you talked about some of the blacks that decided to make their way into white neighborhoods, real estate offices, other people, people who did decide to move into neighborhoods were not just met with taunts and threats of violence. There was actual violence and bombs and some mob mentality, but it got real serious in the early part of 1919, where there were stories and stories of pipe bombs on doorsteps and things of that nature to discourage blacks from expanding out of the Black Belt.
Yes, I would say there were at least a bomb or two a month, and they were planted both at the homes of blacks who moved into white neighborhoods and at the real estate brokers' offices to intimidate them from selling or renting to blacks. And in the working class community, the resistance they showed was more violent. In the middle class community to the east, what they did was they formed real estate neighborhood associations, and it was the beginning of what later became restrictive covenants, which neighborhoods got together and put into law, you cannot sell this property
redlining
to a black person.
Yeah. And it is a lot of the beginnings of what we know of what happened in the 50s and 60s and how white flight and everything that we kind of know about segregation and the South Side of Chicago sort of started to bubble up here at the beginning of the 20th century.
Right. This was really the first wave of that. And we think about it, I think, more in terms of being in the 50s and 60s. But if you look back, you can see the origins were right here, right then, when the black community was just too big to fit into the area that had been designated for them.
Now, this did not go – the other part of this that I wanted to bring up was the media. We kind of talked at the beginning with the Defender and the Chicago Tribune and some of the labor journals. But the Chicago Tribune plays a big part in this book because they were aware of what was happening at the time. And they ran opinion pieces and editorials and editorial cartoons. But there was a very – they were playing to their white audience. I think at one point or another – and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that the Chicago Tribune did an editorial on an op-ed that essentially said the Negro problem in
right.
Chicago.
Yeah, in those days, I think it was considered by a good segment of the white community acceptable to talk about blacks in ways that we would not necessarily do now. So they talked about darkies, for example, coming up from the South.
And this was printed in the newspaper,
right. This was printed as a headline in the newspaper. And letters to the editor, which talked about the Negro problem. But in addition to that, each newspaper was gearing how it talked about what was going on to a particular segment of the population. And there was this kind of revving up of emotions through the media. And so that was part of what set off the riot in the end, because people were very emotional and the newspapers fed right into it.
In 1919, in July, when this incident occurred at the beach, one of the fascinating things about it was the game of telephone that happened afterwards. So it was a black teenager was killed by a white man throwing a rock. There was a lot of obviously a lot of discord on the beach at that point as the blacks came down from 26th Street to 29th. There was a confrontation. The police in that form, I believe they arrested some blacks at that point. They didn't.
The
guy who threw the rock did not get arrested at that point. But when it trickled, when the story trickled back to the neighborhoods, it changed.
It did. And this was part of what I think of as hysteria. So whites and blacks who had been on the beach streamed back into their respective communities, which were side by side. And in the black neighborhood, they exaggerated what had happened on the beach to be larger than it was. And in the white neighborhood, they actually turned the facts around to say that it was a white kid who had been killed by a black. And so all it did was to rev things up. And then later on, as the riot progressed, you could see in the newspapers more revving up. There was an issue about women, and women, of course, are always a sensitive subject when there's violence, and particularly white women and black men. And the Tribune reported that a white woman had been, I don't remember if it was killed or just assaulted. I think it was killed.
With a child, right, too?
Yeah, and a child.
Yeah.
And the Chicago Defender reported the same thing about a black woman. And in fact, there were no women at all that were killed in the riot. But this kind of thing took on a life of its own.
A lot of the what happened after the fact had to do with those two neighbors, the Black Belt and Packingtown, the Bridgeport. A lot of it had to do with the roving gangs that protected the area. You know, you think about when we look back on history and you say a riot, of race riot. And it was. I mean, there were 500 people were injured in 38, but it really had to do with a very set group of two, obviously the black community in Chicago was in one particular area, but they were the Irish gangs at that time that were patrolling. They had it out, and they don't necessarily represent all white people that were living in the Chicago area, but they were the ones that were doing a lot of the damage.
Yeah, there were actually 1,300 gangs in Chicago at that time, which is a mind-blowing number, and they crossed all ethnicities and races. However, a good portion of those gangs were kind of like glorified clubs, social clubs. So they would build a fort.
This is the famed Mayor Richard J. Daley was in one of these.
Yes. Yeah. There were a few gangs that were far more sophisticated than that. And there was one gang in particular that in my research came up over and over again called Reagan's Colts. And it was an Irish gang that was tied in at that particular time with politicians. And later, actually, after Prohibition, became tied in with organized crime. So they were pretty sophisticated. And they had it out for blacks in general. There was this one street, Wentworth, which those of you who are White Sox fans or like to go to Chinatown will know where Wentworth is. There was no highway then, of course. And so that was the street that divided the black and the white community, and it was called the Deadline. And Reagan's Colts said if anyone crossed the deadline into their territory, they were going to get it. And they were always looking for opportunities to rev things up.
Mm-hmm.
And they saw this aftermath of the episode on the beach as a perfect chance for them. And they did go through a lot during the riot to try to keep it going and to try to keep people in a frenzy.
And, you know, also on the other side, there were mobs of people who would like in your grandma's case attack streetcars. There were on both sides. I mean, blacks were approached one of the buildings that had white people in the black belt. So it was a full scale riot where mobs of people were looking to beat somebody up who didn't look like them.
That's exactly right. And that situation with the blacks attacking this apartment building of whites was another instance of false rumors. There was a rumor that a white person had shot out the window with a gun at a black person, but there was never any evidence that that happened. So people were just going nuts without stopping to find out what was really fact and what was just rumor.
Claire Hartfield's my guest. We have about 5 minutes left. We're talking about her new book, A Few Red Drops, The Chicago Race Riot of 1919. And we didn't get the other area I had put down was police, because police played a role in the riot, because a lot of the police at the time, especially police in that were patrolling those neighborhoods, lived in those neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And so you had situations where they turned their back on things or aided and abetted or were part of. I mean, there's a great scene in the book where a car comes crashing in the black belt and they look to the cops to arrest, and he holds his badge up and you realize that some of the protests, or not protests, but some of the rioters were actually police officers.
Right.
So that plays a big role in this as well.
It does. The police situation and its connection to the ethnic communities goes way back to, again, when the Irish did not get any help in terms of getting a foothold in the society from others. They turned inward. And one of the things they did, to their credit, really, to get jobs for their people, was to really focus on getting people in from their community elected to government.
Right.
And once that happened, then they were able to parse out these jobs to the police and fire departments.
I mean, it's the beginnings of the Chicago machine as we know it.
It was. And so the deal then was that these police officers were to protect those communities. And so they did. And the flip side of it was that they ignored crime against blacks often, not always, but often, that went on in the black community. And so there was great distrust in the black community of the police force.
A lot of these areas, and we talked tonight about neighborhood segregation, organized labor, media, police, jobs, crime. A lot of these issues are all relevant today in 2018, especially in the city of Chicago. When you do this book and you talk about something that happened, geez, you know, almost 100 years ago, coming up on 100 years ago. Do you see that? Do you see the relevance that, that a lot of the things that, that are happening here, and whether it be the distrust of police or neighborhoods and segregation or the jobs and crime, I mean, do you see the way that they sort of rooted themselves in the story that you tell in this book?
I do. One of the reasons that I decided to write the book, actually, was because of the parallels to today. And partly because I think that when you are right in the middle of a traumatic period, it's hard to see your way out of it to some degree. And you can't see all of the reasons that it happened, and you can't see exactly what's going to happen in the future. And by looking at it from a historical point of view, where you can see the beginning, the middle, and the end of that segment, it can be helpful in showing you and giving you ideas to think about what went wrong, what did they do that we might build upon and do right, how can we do better this time, how can we avoid some of the pitfalls that there were before, and particularly in this age where a lot of people feel very polarized. Looking at the issue from all sides, I think, can be helpful to opening up a dialogue. And once you get that going, there may be, you know, a you can sort of get rid of the block and the dam, and begin to set things on a better path.
It's a great read. It really is, for anyone who wants to understand the city that you live in or where you come from. The book, A Few Red Drops, The Chicago Race Riot of 1919, is out now. Claire Hartfield is the author. She's my guest tonight. She's going to be reading from it tomorrow night at the American Writers Museum here on Michigan Avenue at 6 o'clock. And on Martin Luther King Day, she will be at 57th Street Books in Hyde Park. That's on Monday at 6 o'clock as well. Claire, can't thank you enough for writing this book and also coming in and talking to me tonight at the big table. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure to be here.